I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. Welcome to the first substantive episode of The Prosecutors. And today, we're talking about the mysterious death of Elisa Lamb. Hello, everybody. It's Brett, and I'm joined, as always, with my wonderful co-host, Alice.
Hey, everybody. It's Alice. Brett, it's so good to talk to you. I haven't seen another human in a long time.
I know, this isolation.
Another human outside of my family. They're humans,
outside
too.
Of your just family. They are humans,
different.
Too. So, you may notice a slight difference in sound quality today from the first episode. And that's because in between the first episode and this episode, our state issued a stay-at-home order. And because we're law-abiding citizens and because we're prosecutors in particular, we are abiding by that order. So Alice is recording from a remote location in her closet.
It's very remote. And how appropriate. This is the most alone I've been from my family.
Yes. How is that with the newborn and the toddler?
Oh, super easy. My children are angels, and it's super easy to work and record a podcast with two kids, two and under. Just kidding. It's a Lord of the Flies over here.
You may recall our rule that everybody lies. That includes podcasting hosts. Well, I was on the keto diet for a while there and lost a bunch of weight. I have now regained all that. Now I'm on the Oreo diet. I have my bag of Doritos and Cheez-Its. So whenever we come out of quarantine, it'll be an interesting time.
You have Oreos? I'll trade you your Oreos for, we have some black beans.
Oh, you know, I think I'm going to have to turn you down on that one.
That's a bummer.
So everybody, we talked a lot about what episode we wanted to do first on the podcast, and we went through a couple different options. But we settled on Elisa Lamb. It's a case that I think probably everybody who's listening to this is familiar with. And we had several reasons for picking this one. And I sort of want to save that discussion for the conclusion of this episode or the next episode, whenever we finish telling the story. But I will say, I think that the case of Elisa Lamb has a lot of the factors that both make true crime an interesting thing, but also some cautionary elements about how we treat these cases and how we treat the people who are involved in them. With that, we'll jump in. So for those of you who don't know who Elisa Lamb is, Elisa Lamb was a young lady from Canada, of Chinese descent, who disappeared mysteriously in early 2013, and her body was later found even under more mysterious circumstances. So to give you some of that background, it's early 2013, it's January, and Elisa Lamb has decided to take a trip down the West Coast from her home in Vancouver, where she is studying at the University of British Columbia. And she takes an Amtrak train from San Diego. She's going to Santa Cruz. She's going around the West Coast, and she stops in Los Angeles. I just want to take a pause here and say that I once took an Amtrak train from Washington, D.C. all the way to my home, which was 16 hours away, and it was not as luxurious as one might think.
Bro, what kind of people are on those really long Amtrak train rides? I've never been on such a long one.
You know, it's a cross-section of America, really. I don't know what I was imagining. I think I was imagining something out of a movie. And It wasn't that at all. I was just sitting in a regular seat. And I guess I was supposed to be there for 16 hours. And this gentleman sitting next to me was a very nice man, but he had been a cross-country trucker. And he tells me towards the beginning that as a cross-country trucker, he had learned to never fall asleep while in a moving vehicle. So he's like, so I'm going to be awake all night. So I ended up just going to the dining car and hanging out in the dining car until the internet went off, which wasn't very long. It was an eye-opening experience. I will say that, you know, everybody loves trains.
So why would someone choose to take a 16-hour train instead of flying or even driving?
So I was doing this, well, I was doing this over Thanksgiving, and it was a lot cheaper to take a train than to fly. But I also had these sort of romantic notions of what it was going to be like to be on a train, that I was going to meet all these fascinating and interesting people, you know, some mysterious young woman on the train with me and fall in love or something. But that's not what happened. But I can imagine why Elisa Lam would decide to take this Amtrak train trip down the West Coast, because it probably did seem exciting. And she was doing it a little differently. She was stopping at all these different places. And, you know, she was very close to her family, so she was checking in with her family the whole time. They weren't overly excited about her doing this, but she was 21 years old. She's a young woman striking out on her own, and she ends up in Los Angeles. And when she does, she checks in to a Los Angeles hotel called the Cecil. The Cecil is, I mean, infamous is a strong word, but I think you can use it here. The Cecil has its own Wikipedia entry for list of death and violence at the Cecil Hotel. And I'll just go through some of them. Elizabeth Short, who was the Black Dahlia, is rumored to have spent some time in the bar there. That's highly disputed. But given the lack of information on her last few days, it wouldn't be surprising if she did that. Richard Ramirez, who was a serial killer, stayed there. So did Jack Unterger, who was also a serial killer. And a number of people have committed suicide at the Cecil Hotel. In fact, if you check out that Wikipedia entry, you'll see incidents after incidents after incidents of people who've either jumped out of a window or committed suicide by ingesting poison or sleeping pills. It's a place that has a sort of dark reputation in Los Angeles.
So, Brett, that's kind of a creepy, like, history for the hotel. Do people typically go there because they like that it might be haunted or has this creepy past, or is it just a normal functioning hotel that people stop in because it's, you know, cost effective?
So it is the kind of place that ghost hunters go and try and see if they can discover anything paranormal. But you're right that generally speaking, it's a cheap hotel. And it's the kind of place that a 21-year-old who's traveling on her own dime and doesn't have a lot of money, it's the kind of the place she might stay. It's not in a great part of town. People call it Skid Row. And it also is the kind of place that has hostel-style rooms. Now, it has single rooms, but it also has rooms with multiple people. And Elisa Lam initially is staying in one of those rooms, actually has 8 people total in it. So you can imagine how cheap that is. Later on, she's moved to a room on her own. We'll talk about why later. So she's there in early January. And then on January 31st, her parents don't hear from her. And this is very unusual. She typically calls them every day. So when they don't hear from her, they call the police. The Los Angeles police, they go to the Cecil Hotel. They talk to the hotel management. They start looking around. They can't find her. And so they ask to see surveillance video that they have there at the hotel. Turns out most of the cameras don't work. There are only really 2 functioning cameras, a camera on the lobby and a camera in the elevator. And when they look in the elevator, they find footage that has since become famous of Elisa Lam acting bizarrely. And so we'll talk about that later on as well. If you haven't seen that footage, we're going to watch it. You should watch it with us. Now, one thing the police do, they conduct a very thorough search of this hotel. They come in with dogs. They knock on every door. They try and search every room. They go from lobby to the roof, and they take those dogs everywhere. but they don't find her. And so the assumption is that Elisa Lam has, maybe she's been kidnapped, maybe she's moved on, maybe she's been killed. But one thing everyone thinks is that she's not in that hotel room. So 2 weeks after this video is published, reports start coming in from guests complaining about water pressure. They're complaining about the color of the water. Some of them say it's black. They're complaining about a weird taste coming from the tap water. The hotel, they send up a maintenance worker to check out these water tanks that they have on top of the hotel. And when he arrives, he notices a couple things. He notices that the ladder that maintenance workers use to get to the top of these tanks is sort of askew. Normally, it's just sort of sitting flush with this tank. It's been moved. He puts that back where it is. He climbs up, and he notices that the top of the water tower is open. And when he looks in, he sees a dead body floating at the top of that water, face up. This, of course, turns out to be Elisa Lam. She's nude. The clothes that she was wearing are actually floating in the tank with her. The police are called. They actually, in order to get her body out of the water tank, they have to drain the rest of it. The fire department has to cut a hole in the side to remove the body. The inside of the tank, and this sort of surprised me, the inside of the tank has, there's no ladder. There's no way to get into the tank and then get out of the tank. So once you're in the tank, you're stuck.
How big was the opening at the top of the water tank?
So that's a question I was surprised by the answer to. If I remember correctly, it was 18 inches by 18 inches, which is not very big square. Now, Elisa Lam's not a very big person. But in order to get into that water tank, you know, you'd have to squeeze a little bit. If you imagine, you know, if you think about your own body type, I think I would have a really difficult time getting inside. You would probably have less of a difficult time.
But I probably couldn't like trip and fall in. I'd have to go in like feet first or head first. I couldn't just like belly flop into it.
I think one thing that's clear from the circumstances, like you said, the size of the opening and everything else, is Elisa Lam either chose to go into that water tank or someone put her there. I don't think there's any other option. I don't think this might have been an accident for reasons we'll talk about, but it wasn't that kind of accident. It wasn't an accident where she just fell in.
And just to get a little bit more clarification, you mentioned that Elisa was naked. Was she completely naked? And were all of the clothes that someone would be wearing, I'm talking about like your underwear, your socks, shoes, were those all floating in there with her?
So yes, she was nude and all of her clothes were in the water tank with her. You can find lists of those clothes online. One thing that people point to as being unusual, she did have a pair of men's shorts, like men's running shorts. I kind of feel like that's the kind of thing that only a man would think is unusual. I've mentioned that to several of my female friends, and they all say, yeah, that's not surprising at all.
I'll say, especially in the time of quarantine when I may be eating more sweets than I should be, men's running shorts are a lot more comfortable to wear.
Exactly.
In other words, I definitely wear men's shorts sometimes, especially to lounge around if I don't care about how I'm looking to go out.
Now, the weird thing about it is when you watch the video, you can see what Elisa Lam is wearing, and she's wearing a full outfit. So apparently, in addition to the full outfit, she was also wearing these men's shorts. So I guess that might be considered a little unusual. I don't know that it's evidence of another person or a man was with her. I don't know why they would leave their shorts there. But it is something some people point to as being a little unusual. Obviously, this was a huge deal. And the question immediately arises, you know, how did she end up in this water tower? Why didn't the police find her before? Why didn't the dogs track her to the water tower? And, you know, did she do this to herself or did somebody do it to her? So the first thing that people look to. And I think the first thing you have to look to is the autopsy report, because the autopsy report is going to tell you so much. If there's evidence of murder, if Lisa Lamb was murdered, you're going to find it in the autopsy report.
You know, her body wasn't found until almost or more than 2 weeks after she was reported missing. How good are autopsy reports when a body's been decomposing for that long and furthermore in water?
So that's a great question. In preparation for this podcast, I actually spent a lot of time reading medical journals on drowning victims, which was fascinating, but also for reasons that are unclear to me, you read these things and you know, you're electronically flipping through the pages and all of a sudden it's like, boom, here's a dead person who drowned. And drowning victims are often not pleasant to view. Propeller damage is horrific. But you're right. There are issues that arise when you have a drowning victim. There are issues that arise when a body's in water for a long period of time. And some of those you see play out in this case. Now, some things you don't have. Typically, if you have a drowning victim, so say someone drowns in a river, you're going to have injuries that don't correspond to the crime itself. So a body is going to be dragged along the bottom of the river. It's going to hit branches and rocks. That's going to cause injuries. One thing that coroners have to do, they have to differentiate between injuries that are caused after postmortem by, you know, the fact that you're floating down a river, and injuries that might have resulted in death. The other thing you have is animal predation. This is a huge problem. You know, most rivers, lakes, oceans, whatever, there are a lot of animals that feed on dead bodies. You see this in cases like the West Memphis 3, but really anywhere where you have bodies that are submerged. You don't have those problems here. Obviously, Lisa Lamb is contained. She's in a water tank. There's no animal predation problems. There are no injuries that'll be caused by something like floating down a river. So if she has an injury on her, it probably is one that was caused, I mean, if there were a crime, by whoever committed the crime.
So what'd the autopsy report show?
With the autopsy, I think a lot of people just assumed, given where the body was found, given the history in the Cecil Hotel, that there would be a lot of evidence that a crime was committed. But when you look at the autopsy, you actually don't find that. And the autopsy is going to be available on the website with this case, prosecutorspodcast.com. But if you look at it, you open it up, and the very first thing you see, 21-year-old Asian woman found in a water storage tank on the roof of her hotel. So you do have moderate decomposition. That's an issue. We'll talk about how that becomes an issue in a second. But the thing right after that, no trauma. And I just want to stop and talk about some of those rules that we laid out in our very first episode. And one of those was that if you don't have evidence of a crime, you probably don't have a crime. It's hard to kill somebody without trauma. It's hard to force someone into a water tank without trauma. And the kind of thing that you would expect to see in this case, I mean, imagine, I mean, once again, she was either dead before she went in or after. Well, we know she wasn't dead beforehand because she drowned. And if you read the autopsy report, there's plenty of evidence of that. All of the stereotypical things you would see with a drowning are present there. If you don't believe me, you can read some of those medical reports online. It's actually pretty interesting.
Pushing back a little bit on our rule of, you know, if there's no crime, there's no evidence of crime, there's no crime. There's no trauma here, but is it possible that if someone's drugged, you wouldn't find physical trauma on their bodies? Let's say she's, you know, not conscious.
You know, that is possible. I would wonder whether, so if you think about this rooftop with this water tank, and let's just, you know, let's construct a scenario where murder was committed. One popular theory out there is that some employee of the hotel took an interest in her, decided to kidnap her, assault her, murder her. So let's say they drugged her. what then? Did they take her to the roof and then drug her? Did they drug her beforehand? In order to get to the roof, you have to go up a stairwell. You have to go through a door. You then have to get her to the water tank. Then you have to get her up the ladder to a little platform where the water tanks sit. Then you got to take her up another ladder, and you would have to put her into the water tank through that 18-inch by 18-inch opening. If you did that, I would expect you would see, even though she was drugged, even though she wasn't fighting back, you would see evidence of bruising. You might see cuts. You might see abrasions. According to the autopsy, the only injury that Elisa Lam has is a small abrasion, small cut on her knee. And that's it. I think it would be very difficult to drug someone and get them into that water tank without having that problem.
I think I agree with you there. It doesn't seem like there's evidence of any crime with respect to physical trauma, but the authorities also did a toxicology report, and that is a lot more interesting because there were some substances found in Elisa's body. Now, I'm no doctor, but I know a lot of people have pored over this toxicology report, and it looks like everything she took was something she was prescribed, or at least is a prescription drug rather than a street drug. Doesn't look like she took any sort of illegal substances or even alcohol. But rather, looking at the medicines that she takes, it looks like it's for a bipolar disorder. Elisa did suffer from some sort of a mental disorder, as far as we know, and this was not a surprise. I think she regularly took medications. But we do see maybe some questions about how she's taking these drugs. Brett, do you want to go into that? Because I'm a little confused by it.
Yeah, that's right. Everyone agrees. And if you read some of the things that her parents have talked about and her friends, she struggled with mental illness, particularly bipolar disorder. And at the time, she was taking four different drugs, all designed to treat that bipolar disorder. And I believe the police found those four drugs with her things in the hotel when they went through them. And like I said, we know that she was prescribed those, both from her medical records and from discussions with her family. Before I get into that, to follow up on what you were saying, Alice, it is true there are no other substances found in her blood. What people will point out who think there's something more nefarious going on here is Elisa Lam, by the time the police recovered her body, there was not a lot of blood available for testing. And some people think that's unusual. And that's one of the reasons I actually ended up digging through all those medical journals. Turns out that's actually not that surprising. When you're in water, particularly fresh water, the amount of water in your system increases dramatically. There's all these sort of, you know, I'm not a science major, so I forget. It's like a hypotonic solution. Basically, your blood volume actually increases dramatically as fresh water leaches into your body. But even though the volume increases, the quality is destroyed. Essentially, if you're conducting an autopsy on someone who's drowned, you can't really even use blood from the areas you typically would. You have to go into deep tissue, often from the heart. And that's what we see here in Elisa Lam's autopsy. That's where they were able to get that. And some people say that because they were not able to get a sufficient quality of blood, that the reason you don't see those substances that you might see otherwise is they didn't have enough. They didn't have enough to test. Now, the problem with that is if you look at the autopsy itself, there are only two substances where there was not a sufficient quantity to test, and that was ibuprofen and lamotrigine, which is one of the prescription drugs that Elisa Lam was taking. Your typical things, you know, the things that you would think, drugs, marijuana, methamphetamine, opioids, cocaine, those types of things were not detected. So I think we can exclude the idea that she was drugged and then taken up there and put in that water tank. I think if someone did this to her, they forced her up there through threat and did whatever they did at that point. And the problem with that theory is there's just not a lot of evidence of it. There's no evidence of sexual assault with Lisa Lam. The theory that she was sexually assaulted and that was the motive for this kind of falls apart. There's some people point to pooling of blood in the anal cavity. That's typical of a drowning victim. So that doesn't really prove anything either. Now, look, we're not discounting the idea that being in a water tank for 2 weeks is a really good way to wash away evidence.
And not to discount that she was definitely naked.
Yeah, and she definitely was. And those are, and these are things you all had to explain. These are things that when you come up with a theory, you have to come up with a reason to explain why this is. And, you know, people come up with different theories for what it might be. You know, maybe she went in fully clothed and she's trying to stay afloat. And so she takes off her clothes to make that more easy. Maybe that's a theory that works. I don't know. But it is, when you have something as unusual as this, I don't know that you can ever fully discount the possibility that someone did this to her.
So let's look closer at some of the drugs that were found in her body.
She had four. Well, that's actually, that's an interesting thing. So once again, Lisa Lam suffered from a bipolar disorder. We know that she was prescribed four different medications.
So it looks like Elisa took at least one antidepressant that day. And she had also taken a second antidepressant and mood stabilizer recently, but likely not that day. And then she was prescribed an antipsychotic medication, but that was not in her system, which suggests that she had not taken it recently. And so those drugs all are in line with her diagnoses of bipolar disorder and depression. And some of them are in her system, maybe at different times. So it looks like just based on what's in her system and for how long that Elisa was taking her medications, but maybe not properly, not the way it was prescribed.
And I think you see that a lot with people who prescribed medication for mental disorders. Oftentimes the medication will work and the person will decide they don't need it. And then they have a relapse. And we see that in our cases.
All the time. I think it's actually more common than not, because oftentimes when we get cases with prescription drugs, we're given two points of reference. The prescription tells us what is the perfect use effectiveness of the drug. So if you take it exactly like it's prescribed, how effective it's supposed to be. But then there's oftentimes another metric, and that is the typical use effectiveness. And that is, maybe it's hard to take the drug at the same time every single day. You know, maybe people forget to take it once in a while. Maybe they themselves decide they don't like the side effects, so they do a risk analysis for themselves, and they think, I feel good enough that I don't want the side effects, so I'm going to skip this one dose and kind of be their own doctor. And so the fact that we get these two metrics, the perfect use and the typical use metrics, tells me that a lot of people actually don't take their drugs as prescribed for very normal reasons.
And I think you're right about the side effects. I've never had to take any of these drugs, but my understanding from working with people who do is the side effects can be particularly bad. And that's especially true when you're taking multiple drugs. So just to walk through what Lisa Lam was prescribed, she was prescribed venlafaxine, which is something called an SNRI. And the way that works, to those of you who these words mean anything to, is it prevents the reuptake of serotonin and norepinephrine, which is, you know, there's multiple ways you can treat depression. And a lot of them do focus on serotonin and the serotonin level and maintaining that level and ensuring that level is high enough. Another one that she was on was lamotrigine. Now, that's a sodium channel blocker, which apparently acts as a mood stabilizer. Lamotrigine is actually an epilepsy drug, but one of its secondary uses is to stabilize moods. And you often see it prescribed in addition to other antidepressants to sort of take the edge off, I guess, of how they work. Then you have something called how do you think you pronounce this one? Q-U-E-T-I-A-P-I-N-E? Anyways, it's an antipsychotic. And it's described as an atypical antipsychotic. So it's a little on the unusual side. And then there's bupropion, which is a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor, which once again, you know, you're talking about dopamine, you're talking about these chemicals in the brain, which are really the basis for mental illness. I mean, a lot of people, I mean, there's debates about all this, and I don't want to be on either side of the debate, so don't write in and yell at us. But the brain works on the basis of chemicals. If the chemicals are imbalanced, you're going to have issues. And I think that's the theory behind a lot of these drugs and the way these drugs work.
And I'm going to break in for just one moment and defend Brett on his pronunciation. So I've definitely had cases where I had to be in court and pronounce a lot of drug names that I've never seen before. And I usually spend up to an hour saying the drug name appropriately in my office with the door closed over and over and over. So way to go, Brett. That was really good. But just so you know, even if we were litigating cases about these drugs, I wouldn't know how to say them. And I have to do a tongue twister right before I go into court to pronounce them correctly.
And we took the easy, or no, we took the hard way out. We did not take the easy way out and use the
brand name.
The brand names, exactly. So bupropion is Wellbutrin, which you've probably heard of. Venlafaxine is Effexor. Lamotrigine is Lamictal. And then the really difficult one to pronounce, quetiapine, is Seroquel. So you've probably heard of all of those drugs. They're very commonly prescribed, and all of them were prescribed to Elisa Lam. Now, as Alice said, it's pretty clear from the autopsy report that Elisa was not taking her medication religiously. And if you look at the autopsy report, you have the blood that came from the heart and what was present there. And then the autopsy report also goes into what you find in the liver. Typically, if it's in the blood, it's something you've taken recently. If it's not in the blood, but it's in the liver, then you've taken it, but not as recently. And obviously, if you don't find it either one, you haven't been taking it. So what we do find in her blood work is bupropion and venlafaxine. So we find both of those in her blood. And that's it as far as the blood work goes. The other two are not present in her blood. Now, lamotrigine, along with venlafaxine and bupropion, are found in her liver. So that means she has taken lamotrigine at some point recently enough that she has not fully metabolized it, but not within probably, and this is, you know, don't quote me on this from a medical perspective, but probably not within the last 24 hours, maybe more. And then you don't find at all the quetiapine.
Seroquel.
Which is the antipsychotic. Yes, exactly. The Seroquel, you don't see that at all. You don't see it in her blood. You don't see it in her liver. And that means she hasn't taken this in quite some time. Not entirely sure how long, but certainly not within the last few days.
At least from my experience in litigating cases with drugs, sometimes people won't take the drugs as they're prescribed. But the difficulty, especially with mental disorders, is my understanding is once you are kind of off kilter and not at the stable place where your drugs get you to, you can't just start taking your drugs as prescribed to get back to where you were. You need the treatment of a doctor to restabilize you and perhaps adjust your drugs. In other words, even if you skip one of the drugs today and then tomorrow you're thinking, oh, I shouldn't have skipped that drug, and your mental disorder has already kind of gotten out of hand, you can't just go back to taking it as it was prescribed to reach the stability that you had previously.
That's my understanding as well. And it's actually even worse than that, because with a lot of these drugs, you can't just stop taking them. Doesn't mean you have to take them for the rest of your life, but you need a doctor's care to stop taking them without serious withdrawal effects. And they're not just the kind of withdrawal effects you might see from something like heroin or cocaine, where you really need the drug and you don't have it. they make your mental issues even worse. And if you stop cold turkey on a lot of these drugs, you can experience those symptoms weeks after you stop for the drugs. So you have sort of a perfect storm here of a problem. You're not treating the issues that you have. You may, you know, do something like try and double up on some medication and try and catch up, which doesn't actually work. And to the extent you've stopped taking something that you've been taking, you can experience withdrawal symptoms that make your mental illness even worse.
And again, you know, from our experience taking witnesses who may suffer from mental disorders, one thing that I've noticed is that those patients typically don't know when they are relapsing or their mental disorder is out of control. It's usually someone outside of their disorder, like a family member or someone who sees them often who recognizes that they actually have to go see a doctor. The individual themselves may not actually know that the drugs aren't working or that their skipping of drugs is causing any issues.
And I think that's what's so pernicious about mental illness in these situations is, for the most part, I think you don't know. I think, and this is my experience in dealing with folks who have these problems, and it's really sad. And a lot of them have problems that I think were probably far worse than what Elisa Lam had, but they believe that their version of reality is reality. You know, I've had cases where people think they are prophets and they speak to God. And God speaks back. And you know, a religious person myself, I often speak to God, but he rarely talks to me, and he certainly doesn't tell me to go commit crimes. But there are people who believe that, and they believe it because they do have this mental issue. And a lot of them respond well to medication, but they won't take their medication. And you know, I've had cases where people have been institutionalized and they've been forced to take medication and they've recovered, and you think, okay, you know, this person is going to be fine. You know, they can finally sort of live the life they deserve. And then they stop taking the medication because they are fine and they go right back to where they were. So I think you're right. It's like I said earlier, there is a perfect storm here. It's not something where you know in the back of your mind, you know, you might say for the average person who's addicted to heroin, for instance, that they are addicted to heroin and they feel compelled to take it in a very serious way. But I think most of them sort of in the back of their mind know that what they're doing is going to kill them eventually. And they would like to stop. They just can't. And that's not the circumstance you have with mental illness. It's not something where all it takes is, you know, gumption and how to and deciding to be better and you can recover. And I think that's something a lot of people think. And it's something a lot of people think who've never had any experience with it. Because once you see it, you understand that is not right at all. It's no more correct than, you know, you broke your leg. Well, rub some dirt on it and get back to running, right? That's not how it works. You got to fix the break. And it's the same way with mental illness.
So, Brett, what do you make of this? No illegal drugs, no alcohol in her system. It doesn't sound like she was partying anytime close to her death. And it looks like she was at least trying to take some of her prescribed medications.
We're probably sort of telegraphing to folks where we're headed on our theories about this. I think there are a lot of people who, they see this story, they listen to podcasts about the story, they read books about the story, and I've done all of those things, and they want to believe that something happened here, that this is something more than someone who had mental illness and they had a sort of a mental break and they ended up finding themselves in a water tank. And I understand that. And I even read one website that was going through theories about how this might have happened. And the first theory was Elisa Lam had a mental break and did this to herself. And they criticize that as victim blaming. Oh, you're blaming the victim. Well, guys, she either did or she didn't. And nobody's blaming her for it. No one's saying this is her fault. But when you're looking at these crimes or potential crimes, you know, one thing you have to look at is victimology. You have to look at the characteristics of the people who were involved. And you have to look at the evidence you have. And you have to develop the best theory possible. And if it is the case that Elisa Lam had a mental break, then she had a mental break. It's no more her fault than, you know, if somebody walks down a deserted alley at 2 o'clock in the morning, they have every right to do that. They should be able to do it safely. But if they get mugged, you can point to those factors as what led to the crime happening. It doesn't mean it's their fault. Doesn't mean they should be blamed. That is doubly the case here. If Elisa Lam was suffering from mental illness, the way to honor her is not to ignore that, and it's not to make up fantasies about what happened. It's to address it squarely. But, you know, we're keeping an open mind here, and we're going to walk through this evidence. We're going to look at this video. We're going to see what happened in the hotel. We're going to look at her interactions with people in the hotel. Is there any evidence that she came into contact with people who meant her harm? Now, we've looked at the autopsy. We don't see any obvious signs of trauma. You know, one thing you would look for here is this seems like the kind of case where somebody would be strangled. Since you don't have drugs, you strangle someone until they pass out, drop them in the water tank. She then drowns. We don't see that here. Strangulation is something that's actually pretty easily diagnosed, and there's no evidence of it. So that didn't happen.
Have you ever traveled by yourself? Like completely by yourself?
I went to China by myself, actually. I was there for a while, and then I met up with a friend. So I was there for a few days beforehand. And I don't love it. I know people who love to travel by themselves. It is not my thing. I like to be with people. What about you?
Well, why do you say that? Why do you say you don't like it? Is it because you're bored or you're scared?
I'm not scared. I don't know. I like to share things with people, you know? I would like to be the kind of person who could sit on my front porch and rock for hours on end and contemplate my own thoughts or something, but I'm just not that person. I'm just not. I want to be with people. I want to be doing things. I want to be, if I'm seeing something beautiful, I want to talk to somebody about it. So, you know, I go to China and I go to Beijing and I'm in the Forbidden City. I'm at the, you know, the Temple of Heaven, and these are just amazing, incredible things that I'm seeing, and it's just me. I went to the Great Wall, and it's just me, right? I got to find random people to take pictures of me on the Great Wall. I didn't like that. So I was much happier when my friend arrived a few days later, and we were able to get together and sort of do our own thing, or not our own thing, do something together.
Yeah, same here. I've never traveled completely by myself. There's usually at least one person that I'll meet there. I may travel there, you know, by plane to another country by myself. But eventually, once I get there, I meet up with people. And part of the reason for me is stories like Elisa Lam's. I think especially growing up as a, you know, somewhat petite lady, girl, I always have in the back of my mind, what if something tragic happens to me? And if I'm alone, no one would know what happened.
And if, you know, Elisa Lam, and I think that was why her parents were concerned that she was doing this. But if you sort of read her history, she was kind of a loner. She was somebody who spent a lot of time by herself. And some of that was because of the mental illnesses that she struggled with. Now, she had a blog. She had a Tumblr account. People spent a lot of time on those, you know, looking through sort of things she had posted in the past. And there's a lot of sadness there because it's quite clear that Elisa Lam was somebody who had a bright future ahead of herself. She was obviously smart. She was creative, but she did struggle with these things. And she talks about spending days on end just in her room, not wanting to leave. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why traveling by herself was both not unusual and also probably attractive for her. And, you know, I wonder, and I don't know this for a fact, but a lot of times people go on trips, it's sort of a psychological way to get away from issues you have or problems you have, you know, new scenery, new outlook, and that kind of thing. So I do wonder, you know, what all she was going through when she sat out on this trip, if she was going through anything at all. And we'll never know that. And I don't think she was the kind of person who would have shared that with someone necessarily beyond what she shared on her website and on her Tumblr.
You know, it is interesting that you noted something at the beginning when you said you wanted to take that Amtrak ride for 16 hours because maybe you'd meet someone wonderful. Even though Elisa chose to take this trip by herself, and it sounded like she
typically like to travel alone or be alone, she did ultimately choose to share a room with, you know, seven other people in a hostel setup. Now, maybe finances were the reason for that decision, but she did share a room with other people. So maybe there was some sort of a, you know, loneliness or a hope there that things could be different.
Yeah, you know, I think that's possible. And I think there is obviously, for many reasons, this is a tragic case, but there is that sort of thread of hopefulness that she had going out on this trip and what it might mean. And for it to end the way it did is just, it's hard to get worse than what it is. But I think, and I talked about this a little bit at the beginning about why we chose this case. I mean, this case to me is one of the saddest cases that we'll deal with. And it's one of the saddest cases that people deal with typically. And I think one of the things that's always bothered me about it is I feel like people don't treat it that way. I think the air of mystery and this sense of the unusual, people, you know, they treat it like a movie or like, you know, a mystery book or whatever. And they kind of forget this is a real person who had real problems, whose life ended in one of the worst possible ways. And I think that's true in a lot of ways of every case we'll look at, but this one is particularly bad and something I don't want to forget as we move forward. I think we're about out of time for today. Obviously, we got a lot more to do on Elisa Lam. We're going to take a look at that video in the next episode. We're going to walk through some of the theories people have. We're going to walk through some of the evidence people present for why this must have been a murder and see if we can figure some of that out. You guys can follow us on Instagram, follow us on Twitter at prosecutorspod. You know, shoot us an email. Tell us everything we've done wrong. prosecutorspod@gmail.com. We've put a lot of documents up on the website that are attached to this case, including some documents that have not been available up to this point. We'll talk about some of those tomorrow. The website's prosecutorspodcast.com.
Thanks for joining us on a really interesting and tragic story. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. Join us next time for a lot more discussion about the evidence and what we think happened.
And until that time, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. Okay, I'm going to try and pronounce this one. If somebody wants to shoot us an email and explain how this is actually pronounced. Quatiapine?
Quetiapine?
Quetiapine?
Quetiapine.
Oh, no. Yeah, there you go. Quetiapine.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.